You are listening to The Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM KVSHLP, Vashon Island, Washington. We stream at voiceofvashon.org. I am Jeff Hoyt, here with my better half, Cindy. Hey, Cindy.
Hey, lesser half.
Yes. We haven't done anything on the radio together in a while. We used to host the Morning Scramble together, but we are here to do a VOV special, and that basically means that I want to talk to somebody interesting, and so we just commandeer the airwaves, and we start. It's been 14 years now since Amanda Knox came home after spending 4 years in an Italian prison for a crime that she did not commit. A couple years later, she wrote a New York Times best-selling memoir called Waiting to Be Heard, which details her entire ordeal abroad, along with what it was like to still be dogged by media attention upon her return home and the challenges she faced in reintegrating. Well, it's been 12 years now that have passed since then, and Amanda has learned a lot about being an unintentional public figure. She found her voice in the global innocence movement, and she moved out here to Vashon Island. She got married, started a family. And this week, her new memoir, Free, My Search for Meaning, came out. And a Hulu TV series about her story is in production now and due to be broadcast later this year. It's a lot. Amanda Knox, welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me. Yeah.
You have been busy.
Oh, my God. Have I been busy?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't sleep much these days.
Yeah.
But it's good. It's good to be busy. It's good to feel purposeful.
Well, if what we do as humans is live and learn.
You hope.
Yeah,
you hope.
That would be the ideal. Then would it be fair to say that your first book was more about living with what happened to you and your new book is more about learning from it?
Damn, that's a really nice way of saying it. I'm going to steal that from you.
There you go.
Yeah, so I feel like Waiting to Be Heard was, I wrote Waiting to Be Heard while I was still very much on trial and defending myself. And it was a really important book for me to write because I had felt like up to that point, so many people had been authoring my experience and saying what had happened and who I was. And so I felt like I needed to react and just give my version of the events so that I could hopefully just be judged for who I was. And so, yeah, it was a very important book for me to write at the time. But was it like the book that really defined my experience in terms of everything that I've learned and how I've understood this experience in terms of who I am? No. I mean, I was still surviving it. In fact, I think...
it was just a couple of years after you came home.
Yeah. I mean, I started writing it a few months after I got home. Mm-hmm. So it was very much something that I had been thinking about a lot in prison. And like I had this vision in my mind of what that book was going to be. And Waiting to Be Heard is that. It is responding to the realities of the trial and the intricacies of the case, which I felt were grossly misrepresented and misunderstood. And so I was trying to set the record straight in a way. This book, Free, My Search for Meaning, is very much what happens on the other side of the curtain. What I mean by that is a lot of people, when they approach wrongful conviction stories, they really look at the kind of things that I wrote about in Waiting to Be Heard. What is the case? And, you know, did she get out of prison or didn't she? The end. And what happens on the other side of that, you know, the curtain falls down, the end, is a whole other human drama that actually is so defining of the human being at the center of it. Waiting to Be Heard was the story of what happened to me. Free, My Search for Meaning, is what I have done about that. And it's led me down some great experiences that I've had and some very not so great experiences. It's very much a journey of misadventures and failures and triumphs and learning along the way.
And the difference in maturity between a 24-year-old and a 30-year-old. I mean, that is a lot of difference.
Yeah, it's a lot of difference. It's also, I think, a big thing is I've been able to think about what happened to me from a position of not being like a prey animal, that your mind is in survival mode for so long. And so you're reacting on a very present level and you're not really able to get that depth of perspective that comes with time and with space and with distance. And while I still have actually been on trial all this time, I have had the ability to step back and to have some life experience between me and the worst experience of my life. And I've been able to sort of integrate that experience into my broader understanding of the world and who I am and my place in it.
You go into great detail in this book about the mistakes that you made. And there were a few.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, what I like to say is I've made a lot of mistakes in my life, just not the ones that you think you know about. So, you know, again, I come from this place of maybe I'm a little bit traumatized by having too much information put out about me early on, but I'm now in this very TMI space. So when everyone picks up this book, you're going to learn some very intimate things about me that are not always flattering. And, but I think are all sort of echoes of that trauma that happened when a person broke into my home and raped and murdered my roommate and everything that comes from that impact. It's not just what happened in that moment. It's what is happening to lives in the aftermath.
In that aftermath,
yeah.
A lot of those mistakes were born out of you wanting to trust people
mm-hmm.
and see the best in them. And people didn't always have your best interests at heart.
Yeah. And that was a really hard lesson for me to learn, because after being pigeonholed as this monster for so long, I felt this impulse to want to give everyone the benefit of the doubt, because that had been denied to me. And then that led me into situations where I was taken advantage of in very big and scary ways. And so lesson learned. And really that moment that we're sort of hinting at in the book was a really traumatic moment for me, because it was the first time that I felt like, wow, something bad could happen to me because of choices I made. Like, everything that happened to me to Italy was not based on my choices, right? Like, there were bad things that just sort of happened to me because of other people's choices. But now bad things were happening to me because of my choices in response to a traumatic event. And I like suddenly felt levels of shame that were unprecedented for me up to that point.
And the really crazy thing about all that limbo time that you spent between the time you got here and the time you were exonerated 4 years later is that you went back on trial. Right around the time Waiting to Be Heard came out,
mm-hmm.
Italy announced, we're going to do this again.
Yes. Yeah.
And so during that time, you not only couldn't really get your life started, there was just, you had to keep your head down
mm-hmm.
and you had to be careful about public appearances. And
And I was scared of people.
Yeah.
I was in a prison. I was in a very different kind of prison. It wasn't
right.
made of bars and cement walls and barbed wire. It was made of judgment and feeling like I was forever being looked at through the worst possible light. And therefore, I could not make any mistakes, or else it would be the end of my life.
And yet you did, and you made mm-hmm. those mistakes, you lived through those mistakes, you learned from those mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there was a lot of catharsis in laying them out and owning them in this book.
Totally, yeah. I want to like point out, because one of the reasons why I wrote this book is because my experience is not unusual in the wrongly convicted world. Like, people who are wrongly convicted, first of all, the vast majority of them you don't ever hear about, because not every case rises to the level of international insanity and notoriety that my case did. But if you talk to any wrongly convicted person, like, they're a real person and they're trying to figure out who they are in this world and they're making mistakes along the way. But they are also held to that standard of, once you've been accused of a heinous crime, you can't, like, you feel like you cannot make the kind of mistakes that any one of us can make, because, oh, that's going to maybe make people think that you really were guilty, even though you were proven innocent. And so there's this like level of paranoia and fear that people who have been wrongly convicted live with in the aftermath, because you're, that feeling that you have to prove your innocence every day of your life doesn't go away even after you've been exonerated. And so when I talk about like the mistakes that I made, I kind of want to show other people that like, it's okay to make mistakes, and it's not the end of the world, and it's not the end of your life when you make a mistake. You really, like, if I can make a mistake and serve, like, seriously, then you can make a mistake and turn it around and learn from it and grow from it.
You also display a lot of strength in this book on so many different levels, but you've always pushed back when the media or filmmakers decide to try to put you back in their crosshairs.
I'm kind of stubborn that way.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think people really knew who they were reckoning with when they reckoned with me.
What would be your advice for people who find themselves unfairly thrust into the public eye the way you were?
Well, one thing that I like to remind people is that so much of what is thrust upon people in the form of an accusation is really a projection of another person's fear or anxiety or whatever it may be. And so I have come to realize that so much of the hatred or mean-spiritedness that comes my way, or even just pigeonholing that comes my way, is a projection of someone else's mental image. It's not personal. I've learned to not take those kinds of things personally. And not only does that give me a level of peace about it, that I don't, you know, feel anxiety about, like, oh my God, am I really like this horrible person that they're saying? It's like, no, I'm not. Mm-hmm. So I can be at peace with that. But it also allows me to understand, like, oh, where is everyone coming from when they are looking at me and they are seeing this nightmare figure? Like, they're projecting that onto me. Well, knowing that that is a projection that is in their head, how do I address that? It gives me a level of clarity that allows me to sort of address the hidden underlying need that is being expressed through that fear and that aggression or that pigeonholing.
That kind of skill is hard to come by. I mean, it reminds me of the phrase, who is more deadly, the frightener or the frightened? Because the frightened are going to lash out with everything they have. And it's almost never accurate. When I think about what you went through and are still in some ways going through, just in terms of global judge, jury, and executioner, and like you said, everyone you meet for a long time. And is it tapering off now to a great extent because of the fight back?
That's a great question. So one thing I like to think is that one choice that I've made in my life is to do the best I can with what I have and to not feel compelled to perpetually have to respond to the accusations that are coming my way. And instead of just addressing those head on, it's instead to be my best self in my way possible and in that way prove who I am. That has led me down some really interesting paths that I talk about in the book. But it's also made me feel less a slave to what other people think about me. And I think that weirdly has worked the best at addressing that problem that you raise. At the same time, it also means sort of acknowledging that this horrible experience of my life is a big part of who I am. And I really struggled with that for a long time, this idea that like I would be forever defined as the girl accused of murder, whether I liked it or not. And I've learned to think about it a little bit like anyone's credentials, like what school did you go to? Whatever, you know, like you have this many years doing Voice of Vashon such that you can just decide that you get to do whatever show you want at any point you want. Those are your credentials. My credentials is that I was accused of a heinous crime on an international level and I spent a bunch of time in prison and I've had to fight and claw my way back to having a voice. Like those are my credentials. They don't define who I am, but they certainly inform who I am. And I'm okay with that now, but it's taken me a long time to like wrap my mind around what that means and who I could be in light of that background.
I'd like to ask Chris, who's sitting to your right, Chris Robinson.
Oh, hello there.
Hey there.
Oh, welcome. Surprise guest.
Welcome to the conversation. What it's been like for you to be in this position of supporting Amanda, witnessing all of this stuff that has come at her, maybe less so these days than before, but I remember when we first met, you were telling me that you would get up in the morning and check the interwebs and scrub the feed if need be to spare her the stuff that might be coming her way. What was that like?
Vitriol.
Yeah, just acting as a filter for some of the hatred that comes in. I still do that sometimes, but it has tapered off. And I think one of the most interesting things about being in my position, and I'll be fully upfront here that my view is totally biased because
he has a big fat crush on me.
Big crush on me. Yeah. But I know her.
Oh, the Amanda snort.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. We're up to two snorts now.
Oh, I've got more.
Yeah. I'm keeping track.
I know and love her very deeply. And what that means for me is that when I see this false idea out there in the world of who Amanda is, the distance between that image and who I know her to be is actually much greater than I think what your average Amanda supporter, uh-huh, who's like, oh, well, she's not Foxy Noxy, she's just a normal person. I'm like, no, she's not just a normal person. She's actually an exquisitely amazing person.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And we're going to talk some more about that today, too.
And I mean, I was actually just on Goodreads the other day reading the early reviews, so she doesn't have to. And, you know, one of them, I didn't tell you this, but one of them was like, well, Amanda Knox may be extremely weird, but she sure can write. And it was, and I was like, you know, okay, that's sort of a good review, but somehow they still have ingrained in them this image that was built through decade plus of tabloid coverage that misrepresented you as some deeply eccentric off person in some kind of way. And if people were to just have a dinner with you once, they would recognize that not only are you very pleasantly sociable and outgoing and well-adjusted, you know, especially given you're more well-adjusted than most people, and, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. And Cindy's like, I can list all the people I know who are not well-adjusted.
And yet, even among people who believe in your innocence and are willing to pick up a copy of your book and support you, there's still this idea that there's something really strange and off about you. And all the work you've done in your writing and advocacy and all this other stuff to try and correct that false image, that it's so deep. It's so widespread, this idea that you're strange. Hmm. You know?
I mean, one thought that I'm just having now is, again, one of the sort of thoughts that I have, I believe I talk about this in the book, is this feeling, this relationship between me and the public version of me. And again, like, the public version of me is really different in any given person's mind. And I feel like a lot of people put onto that public image Amanda what they want to see. So if it's a devil worshiping sex monster, then that's what they're going to see. If it's a, you know, autistic weirdo, like, that's what they're going to see. And I think it's again, like, I sort of look at that as less to do with me and more to do with what is important to that person and what they're projecting onto the story that is meaningful to them. Everyone's trying to derive meaning from the stories that we either personally experience or we see out there in the world. And so I feel like, I don't know, there's just something about this story and the moment that it came into being that resonated with people for all these different reasons. I will also say that some people look at me as a freaking saint, and that's not true either. Yeah. And so that's the weird sort of tension between me and this public self that I know is an idea of a person that doesn't really exist and that I don't really have control over.
Interacting with that even peripherally, and finding myself, you know, mentioned in a tabloid article that's about you, right? It's such a revelation, and it totally changes how I interact with the idea of other people that I've never met, because I've seen how wrong the media is.
Basic homework level facts.
Yeah. I mean, like here's a great one, right? Like, in Amanda's Wikipedia article, it says that her parents got divorced when she was 10 years old. They actually got divorced when she was 1 year old.
And it's did someone just accidentally press an extra zero on there?
What happened was we found a Wikipedia editor who was offering to help correct some things. And we said, oh, actually, can you change this biographical thing? And he said, well, you'll need a source for that. And right now, that 10-year divorced at 10 years old claim is being sourced to this ABC News piece from 2009 and to this Oprah Magazine piece from, you know, those pieces got it wrong.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's like the actual legitimate news sources out there have a wrong detail that works its way into the encyclopedia. And then,
I said, well,
can Amanda be the source to say, like, this is true? No.
No. Yeah. I need to get the actual divorce papers.
You need to get someone to print it somewhere.
I'd like to go back to back when you had just gotten back and around the time you were writing Waiting to Be Heard, mm-hmm. you detail in this book various people who sort of stepped up and did amazing things for you. I don't know if many people are going to mention this guy, but the editor of the West Seattle Herald did you a big solid.
A huge solid, yes.
You guys might not even know each other if not for that guy.
That is true. That is very true. Yeah. So, full disclosure, Chris comes from a newspaper empire, if you can call it that, the Robinson Communications news empire that is really local news.
Mm-hmm. I don't think empire is the right word anymore.
Yeah. Whatever. I mean, they had a bunch. His grandfather ran a bunch of newspapers and all local. So, you know, the West Seattle Herald, the Ballard News Tribune, they ran all these newspapers and are always looking for local correspondents. And after my book came out, Patrick Robinson reached out to me on Facebook asking if I wanted to be a correspondent for the local newspaper. And my initial feeling was, journalists, stay away, get away from me. Mm-hmm. And I immediately assumed that, again, like, Here's a horrible thing that happens when the whole world views you through the worst possible light is you start to view the rest of the world in the worst possible light.
It's natural.
And so I assumed that he was just reaching out to me because he was thinking, oh, it's going to be scandalous for Amanda to write for the paper.
I'm going to trade on her name.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I was thinking, oh, no, I do not want this to happen to me. But he immediately was like, hey, no, like, chill. Like, I just know that you can write. I read your book. You can write under a pseudonym if you want. And so for like a year and a half, I was able to really learn how to do journalism under a pseudonym.
What was your pseudonym?
Emile Monte.
Emile Monte.
Emile Monte. So Emile.
Did you write with an accent?
Yeah, everything has a little accent mark at the end. Emile, because it was the name of it's actually the name of my cat now, but it's the name of a character from my Oma's favorite childhood book. Mm-hmm. And Monte, because a can of Del Monte peas was sitting at eye level on my, pantry.
You were just that far from being Del Monte.
Exactly. But I thought that was a little too Italian, maybe get away. So that's how Emile Monte came to exist. And weirdly, I felt different feelings about taking on a pseudonym because I was really resistant. People kept telling me, why don't you just change your name, cut all your hair off or dye your hair or whatever, and just pretend to be a different person. And I really resisted that impulse because I felt like that was somehow giving in to this idea that there was something wrong with Amanda Knox. There was something wrong with being me. And I was like, there's nothing wrong with being me. I didn't do anything wrong. And also, what am I supposed to do? Just pretend in all of my relationships that this super defining part of my life just didn't happen? That doesn't seem healthy.
No.
So I resisted that. But then being able to write under a pseudonym gave me the opportunity to practice writing and sharing my thoughts in a low pressure situation. And that helped me to, because like it's the exact opposite of writing a big, huge, splashy memoir is writing a column for the local paper.
Reviewing a play.
But reviewing a play under your name at that time would have invited scrutiny.
Absolutely.
You know, like every word you wrote would be under a microscope.
And I got to feel a part of a community again, right? Yeah. Like that's why local journalism is so important, is because it really is like grounding you in a sense of community. And so while I felt very ostracized and unable to personally participate in my community, I could do so through Emile Monte.
And as a result, and we talked about this the last time we had a conversation on the radio, it was that job that led to you reviewing Chris's book.
This kid's, debut novel.
And then you met through happenstance in many ways. So you just happened to know that he was doing a reading and you wound up meeting and the rest is history. I really connected to that, the freedom you must have felt to be able to write. And then, of course,
And in the way she points out in the book, too, that the reaction she got from writing under the pseudonym was in some ways the most authentic and honest reaction she could get, right? Because people are just interacting with your mind and your words and not with they're not being mediated by that idea of you.
Although I will say, shortly after I started writing under my own name, so a year and a half writing under pseudonym, started writing under my own name for the paper, and I had this experience of just like walking down downtown Seattle street on my way to my job at the local bookstore, and someone stopped me and was like, "Oh my God, you're Amanda Knox." And I was like, "Oh no, here we go again." Mm. And they were like, "I love your column in the paper." And I was just like, oh, that's so great. I'm known for something I actually did by this one guy. And it was so exciting to me. Yeah. So whoever you are, guy, I still think about you.
Well, that sounds like a corner being turned.
It was definitely like a moment of like, oh my gosh, I did something that somebody knows me for that's not this horrible thing that I had nothing to do with. So,
and then the other thing that just kind of came out of left field, and you wouldn't have probably pursued this on your own. Maybe you would have been led to it eventually, but a friend from the Idaho Innocence Project says, Amanda, you need to go down to Portland and go to this conference.
Yeah. So a big part about the book is talking about that feeling of not feeling like I didn't belong to the rest of humanity and the various reasons why, like all these misadventures and misunderstandings between me and the world that led me to feel really like I did not have a place. I wanted to have a place. I wanted to just go back to being an anonymous college student. And that wasn't an existence that was available to me. And so going through a process of feeling really, really ostracized and isolated, and then finding my way again into connection. And one of those big ways of finding connection among many that I talk about in the book was going to my first ever Innocence Network conference. And it was not something that I wanted to do. The last thing I wanted to do at that point in my life was sort of lean into the wrongful conviction aspect of it. I was trying to get away from that.
And kudos to your mom for pushing you.
Yeah. Well, my mom was like, you're acting weird and washing your underwear in the sink and self-isolating and maybe dealing with some depression. So we're going to figure this out. And she just mommed the heck out of it. And I do what my mom says. So when she told me to get into a car, we're driving to Portland for a conference, I was like, okay.
Most of the time you do what your mom says.
She would sing a different
song. that's true. That's true.
I would say that the climax of your book here is a big example of you
doing the
following your
of
instinct
what?
Despite recommendations from your
that
family.
That is true. That is true. We're going to get to that. As a matter of fact,
skipping ahead.
Might be a good time to start down that road.
And you went to the conference in Portland. You met other wrongly convicted people.
Yep.
And
I realized
felt instant affinity for them.
Instant affinity because they made it clear to me that I belonged.
You were not alone.
I was not alone. And also, you know, one of the big takeaways that I will never forget is one person saying to me, thank God you were wrongly convicted, Amanda, because before this little white girl from the suburbs of Seattle got wrongly convicted, no one believed that it was actually happening, that it was really true. And that all of us here, there's hundreds of us here, like we were swept under the rug and people didn't believe that what was happening to us was real. So thank goodness you came around, because now like you are making it apparent to people who would otherwise have overlooked us that this is true and real. And that was like the first moment that I really understood that there was purpose to what happened to me, that I could do something really important, which was to be a bridge between this marginalized community and the rest of the world. And that was really deeply meaningful to me. And it gave me that sense of purpose that I've continued to sort of be swept up by.
Who doesn't want to be a force for good?
I think I can think
of a few people.
Okay. You're right. Those other people were referred to earlier.
But it was so powerful to me because like up until that point, I had been told that my voice didn't matter. Like no matter what I said, it was always misconstrued and people were calling me a liar and a psychopath and why don't you just disappear? And here was a room full of people who were saying, no, please don't disappear, Amanda. We need you to be a voice for us. That was really, really powerful for me.
I think the place where the book really takes off, speaking of purpose, is when you accept an invitation to go back to Italy.
That point, you were a little bored, and then we finally got to the exit.
Finally. This was spring of 2019?
Yes, yeah.
And Italy Innocence Project, mm-hmm. which is kind of just a fledgling organization, mm-hmm. and they need some support. And they
to this day, you. Manned by just yeah. two people. So yeah. two people wow. in all of Italy who are
and
taking
on. And now we
on.
Know how much they need it.
Yes, exactly. So the support Italians. Italy Innocence Project. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Well, you accept this invitation, and this is where your mom and you kind of diverge a little bit, mm-hmm. because she says, what?
Yeah, she...
As well as most people in your life.
Understandably,
you're going back?
My family was not keen on me going back to Italy. Understandably.
Yeah.
But I felt like I had grown up in Italy. Like, this was not just something that I could write off. I felt like I had unfinished business with Italy, and I had been sort of simmering with that feeling for a long time. And the idea of being invited to come back and to speak about trial by media in a very like purposeful way felt like the best way for me and Italy to sort of sort out our unfinished business. And so Chris, who has been my champion in the face of everyone else telling me that I have Stockholm syndrome, he supported me and helped me figure it out. And
I remember having all these conversations in the lead up to that, asking you like, why are we doing this? Mm. Because I was just like, okay, you want to do this? You feel some nebulous drive to go back there? I'm in. Like, I trust you and I trust your instinct, but let's untangle that. Like, why? And one time you told me, because it's hard, which I thought was a super interesting insight into the way your brain works, that like you wanted to go back in part because it was scary.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explore that? Can you unpack that even more for me here? Like, why are you drawn to approaching things that are scary like that?
Well, I think that like all emotions, I think emotions are information. Anger is information. Joy is information. And fear is information. And what I have come to learn is that, and maybe this is just because I had a very, very tough soccer coach, but like what was painful and what scared me, going towards it made it less scary, and moving through the pain made you arrive at a place of strength. Like, I just knew that from my youth experiences. And so I felt like everything I was afraid of, turning away just made me feel more afraid. So I always felt the impulse to turn towards what scared me so that I could really look at it and confront that and get over it. I did not want to spend the rest of my life running away from things that scared me. So my impulse is constantly to move towards things that are scary and to do things that are hard, because I feel like the opposite thing, which is running away from it, is actually harder.
Ultimately,
yes.
It is, because that's the poison that builds up inside your mind and your body.
Exactly. And I don't know. I just somehow intuitively, deeply knew that to be true. And so anytime I'm scared, anytime I think this is going to be really hard, I always say, go towards that.
And yet making that decision, make that trip, especially to talk about trial by media,
mm-hmm.
Resulted in, before you ever went over there, some hits that you took in the media,
mm-hmm.
just for accepting the invitation.
Yes, yes. Well, one of the biggest challenges that I've faced as a sort of a public-facing person is this idea that the very idea of me is offensive, that like, even for those people who don't think that I'm guilty necessarily, there's this like idea that my identity is intertwined with Meredith's. And because I'm the person who survived, there is this, who survived my, you know, study abroad trip and she didn't, there is this constant idea that anything good that happens to my life is somehow a reflection on all the things that Meredith lost. I'll just read this part, and it's okay. About like this idea that like the idea of Meredith and the idea of me are intertwined in the public imagination. Very few people ask me what it feels like to have lost a friend. Meredith and I were young women going through a similar stage in life in a brand new place. We were both studying and meeting people and expanding our sense of the world. We only knew each other for 5 weeks, But friendship, like romance, blossoms quickly in such circumstances. I often feel as if Meredith and I are two sides of the same coin. And when that coin was flipped, I got heads and she got tails. What happened to her could so easily have happened to me. If she'd been away that night and I'd been home, would she have discovered the crime scene? Would she have been wrongly convicted? And would she be reflecting all these years later, feeling like she was both incredibly lucky and tremendously sad? This is like my way of recognizing that, of course, in the public imagination, like me and Meredith are intertwined, but we're intertwined in the wrong way in my feeling. What I do and what I feel is that anytime that I fight for my life, this is my version of the fighting for my life that Meredith did the night that she was killed. And I just happen to be the lucky one who gets to continue fighting. And so, like, it's with that mindset that I confront the how dare you go back to Italy sort of mindset, which is a lashing out at my identity and the fact that I continue to exist in the face of her non-existence.
Your speech over there generated a lot of interest in Italy, and a lot of people watched it. And there were a few surprises along the way, including your first public declaration of a desire to sit down with your prosecutor, Dr. Giuliano Minini. Could you read a little section of the speech that illustrates how you set that up for the audience?
Yeah. To my 20-year-old self, wrongly imprisoned and on trial, Dr. Giuliano Minini was a nightmarish figure, a powerful and frightening man who had only one goal: to destroy my life. I know that image of him is wrong. It is as flat and two-dimensional as Foxy Noxy. It was the media who helped me to see that. In the Netflix documentary, I saw not an evil man, but a man with genuine, noble motivations, who wanted to bring justice to a grieving family. I would like to meet that man, the real Dr. Giuliano Minini, one day. And I hope that when that time comes, he too can come to see that I am not a monster, but that I am simply Amanda. So, yeah, I feel like a lot of people expected me to show up in Italy and sort of wag my finger and air my grievances and then walk out. And because, I don't know, that's what they think of a victim does. Mm-hmm. And I was very clear, like in my speech, like I was absolutely a victim of both media and the criminal justice system, but there was more to it than that. And really, like the way that I even began writing that speech to Italy was thinking about it as a kind of love letter to a person that I cared about that had hurt me. And so like, I literally, like when thinking about like, what do I have this opportunity to go back to Italy, what do I say? I sat down and I started writing a letter, and I started with "Dear Italy." And then as soon as I like imagined Italy as this person, this entity that I care about that hurt me, how do I talk to them? And it involved like acknowledging the humanity of the people who had hurt me, because I have never been satisfied by the idea that what happened to me happened because just some people are evil and they don't care if they put an innocent person in jail. I don't think that that's what really happens. I think what really happens is way more complicated than that. And so because I had been sort of turned into this monster in people's minds, the last thing that I wanted to do was turn another person into a monster in my mind. And so I used this opportunity also to reach out and tell Giuliano Minini, like, dude, I want to talk to you.
And this was the big reveal. This was really the first time this came out, right? Mm-hmm. First of all, you gave the speech in Italian.
Yes, yes. And I felt like it wouldn't make sense to go all the way to Italy and just speak English at them.
Yeah, so. But in this speech, you reveal that you would really like to sit down with your prosecutor, Giuliano Minini, and have a conversation mm-hmm. to try to understand yep. each other.
And as the book reveals, that was an opening. Mm-hmm. And we then...
You had made overtures mm-hmm. prior to this.
I had made overtures prior to this, but it wasn't until I publicly sort of acknowledged his humanity to the rest of the world that he reached back out to me and said, hey, let's talk. And then, of course, this funny little thing happened, which was the pandemic. And so this idea of actually meeting in person became this like, oh, my God, the world's ending. That's never going to happen. But like we...
Especially in Italy.
Yeah, especially in Italy, which was one of the first places that everything was really hammering
Italy
down.
Italy and then Seattle.
Italy and then Seattle, interestingly. Yeah. But so what that led to was actually a sort of a blessing for me where I got to have this years-long correspondence with this person to get to know him before I ever sat down in a room with him. And that, so like that journey I talk about in the book, especially as things are happening in my life and we keep feeling the sort of way that trauma informs grief during those periods because of other personal things that are happening in my life, like having a miscarriage or my daughter's crazy medical diagnosis when she was first born. Like there are lots of things happening, real life living things that are happening as I'm having this correspondence with my prosecutor, and I'm sort of holding those two realities together at the same time and thinking like, what am I doing?
You always, I thought, had a very generous take on Menini's approach in the case. But from my outside point of view, I always believed his motive was more subversive than wanting to spare Meredith's family. Because, you know, what about your family? He didn't seem to care very much about them.
Right.
To my view, he always seemed like he was more of an opportunist. He was like local guy who's got his moment on the world stage and he's going to play it for all it's worth. And that's going to include inventing out of whole cloth fictions about you.
Mm-hmm.
And did you ever think that? And if you did, how did you get past it?
Yeah. So I think one thing that I have always been really clear with him as well as everybody else about is that I do not let him off the hook for the mistakes that were made in the case. A really great example of something that was invented out of whole cloth. This idea that I was in a love triangle with Raffaele and this local burglar who actually killed Meredith. Like that was this little, like convenient little story that they invented completely out of whole cloth in order to make sense of why the three of us might commit a heinous crime together. They needed us to have some kind of relationship with each other. So they just made one up and
supported by zero evidence.
Like Raffaele had never seen Rudy Gadet before in his entire life. I had seen Rudy Gadet maybe once or twice, but only because he was like hanging out with the boys who lived downstairs from us because they all played basketball at the same basketball court. Like the ties were very loose. I didn't even know his name. I didn't have his phone number. There was no, like, there were no calls or texts between us. Like there, like I was meeting people and getting texting, calling everybody that I met in Perugia because I didn't know anybody. Like this was my new friend group. So to have like some secret love triangle was very, very outlandish and very convenient for their, you know, their reconstruction of the crime, which sort of forced three people who didn't know each other together into one room to commit a heinous crime. So, you know, I've never let him off the hook for those things. So when we say I'm being generous towards him, I'm not saying, oh, he didn't do all of those things. What I do say is I can recognize how human beings can convince themselves of even things that are completely made up, thinking that they are deriving those ideas, those projections that they have put onto reality through logic or through deductive reasoning. Like the number of times that Menini's told me, can you just like put yourself in my shoes? And I'm like, I'm doing my best, hon. And I am. I'm really just sincerely doing my best to think like, how could somebody think they were doing the right thing? And how could they unconsciously, like I'm convinced that all of the things that he did that are egregious in this case were in fact unconscious in the sense that I do not imagine him psychopathically, you know, engaging with the world and being like, I don't care if she's innocent, I'm going to put her in jail anyway. I think that he genuinely tricked himself into thinking that this was that all of the things that he believed were in fact what he believed, including the ego angle. Because I think you're right. Like, this was a world stage, and he was thrust on the world stage, whether he chose it or not. He says that he was just happened to be on call that night, and that's why he ended up being the prosecutor of the case. He didn't like hunt, you know, he didn't kick somebody else off the case so he could get it. So he argues, I just happened to be the one who got assigned to the case. I didn't seek it out. Be that as it may, from the very beginning, everyone knew that this case was going to be huge. He says that, you know, he says like one of the reasons why the police overwhelmed you in that interrogation room and it was full of police officers who shouldn't have been there was because every single person in that police office knew that this case would be the case of their career and they wanted to be there. They wanted their names to be on the documents. They wanted the glory of being a part of this case. And so they were flooding the police office to take part in breaking down the mind of a 20-year-old girl. So and it goes to show that like they all thought that they were doing some sort of heroic thing that they would look back on and go, look, my name's on that document. Not like, oh no, my name's on that document that has been proven to be a violation of a young person's human rights. I think that he understood that this case would have an impact on his legacy, and his legacy is very important to him, not just because he had some bad things going on with the Monster of Florence case, the other huge case of his career where he was, you know, accused of abuse of office. He was on trial for abuse. He was convicted of abuse of office in that case. But he looks at the world through this lens of there's this conspiracy against him. And I think it's really important to acknowledge that, yes, on the one hand, there is like a crazy paranoia that is attached to that. But on the other hand, prosecutors in Italy have a different history than prosecutors here in the U.S. Prosecutors in Italy have historically been targeted by mafia and by conspiracies and murdered for doing their jobs. And he has received bullets in the mail over the course of his career doing anti-mafia work. And so it's understandable that subconsciously he has learned to view the world through the lens of conspiracy and through the lens of people going after him and criticizing him, not because he was wrong, but because they are anti-justice. And so that's his first impulse for viewing reality, and that informs why he made the decisions that he made. Now, does it make me generous to acknowledge all of that? I don't know. I just want to view the world clearly, and I want to understand people. I want to understand why harm was done to me. And I feel like knowing all of that history gives me a level of context that allows me to appreciate how those kinds of like unthinkable decisions could be made.
Including pressing forward when all the evidence pointed away from you. That's the part that I have the hardest time forgiving him for. Not that it's my job.
Yeah, totally. I mean, even like some of it even just has to do with how you're feeling like that day. Like, honestly, like if you look at the research and the psychology behind certain, you know, courtroom decisions that are made, sometimes the difference between conviction and absolution is whether or not the judge had a good sandwich to eat for lunch that day. Like, it really, like when you look at like how irrational and sort of driven by our unconscious feelings about things we are, like that, it's kind of shocking. We think we're these rational things, but really we're being driven by these emotional impulses. And one of the big things that's a big takeaway for me from talking to Mignini, and you see this over the course of the book, is how his idea about who I am was radically changed merely by the fact that I acted in a way that was kind towards him. He had zero expectation that someone in my position would be kind to him. And the mere fact that I was kind to him completely changed his perspective about who I am and therefore what my role was in the case that he prosecuted, which goes to show once again that it's really not about the evidence. It's just about how you feel about people. And his sort of insistence on like holding on to some things versus letting go of others, it's all about how he's feeling. And I don't know, like, he to this day does not admit that. And he to this day, like, he insists that he is this logical, deductive person. And I just sort of hear him. I hear him and I hear him repeat that over and over again. But I also hear what he's saying by his actions. Yeah. Like, if you let somebody just sort of be in front of you for long enough, they will reveal who they are and what they really think, regardless of what they say. And that has been my experience with him.
Well, he was supporting his own self-image.
Right. And understandably, because we all are, right? Yeah, we all make true. That mistake. And I think that he, especially now that he's in, you know, the twilight years of his life, he's really thinking about his legacy and he's thinking about his impact. And he wants to believe that he is this justice crusader. And he wants to believe that he didn't commit any intentional harm. And while I think that he was negligent, I do not think that he was intentional in his harm.
And he wasn't special. I think a big point that Amanda's making is that his cognitive biases and his flaws and his ego, all of that just makes him a regular dude. And we all are subject to those same issues. And the difference is that when you're in a position of authority, like being a prosecutor who has the power to put someone in prison for life, you want somebody to be better than the average, right? You don't want them to just be a regular person who's consumed with their ego like all of us. You want that person to be held to a higher standard, to be able to resist the pull of the ego and of the media and all that stuff. But, you know, if someone runs into a burning building to save a dog and they're doing it because they want the congratulations and the media to interview them afterwards, like, no one begrudges them that, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we all are subject to that
kind
of draw.
The right thing for the wrong reason.
Yeah, and you hope that that person wasn't thinking about the TV interview in the aftermath and they were just doing it because it was the right thing to do. But if they were, who cares? They saved a dog. The problem is when they do something like put an innocent person in prison, then we look at that ego-driven thing and say, what a monster. He was doing it for the attention. It's like people do stuff for attention all day long, every day. And you just hope that a person in his position is held to the higher standard, and he wasn't.
But I will say, Cindy, to your point that, like, are there times that he was being disingenuous? I've certainly struggled with that question, especially over the course of our correspondence, and he's been really resistant to certain, like, to acknowledging certain things versus others.
He's never apologized.
Right. And, you know, I talk about this in the book of, like, what he's willing to give versus what he's not willing to give, and the generous version or the generous interpretation of what he has been willing to give and unwilling to give has been he's able to give this and unable to give that because he's just not at that place emotionally and psychologically and spiritually yet. And maybe he never will be. And you know what? That's not on me. Mm-hmm. But, like, the less generous one is he's not giving me that acknowledgement because he's covering his ass. Either way, doesn't really change my calculus.
What's going on in your head?
Right. Because for me, the big shift in realization was it's not about him. My life does not depend upon Giuliano Mignini getting his shit together. and
that's the most amazing thing about you to me is the fact that you came to understand that he wasn't just a snake that bit you, you know, that you had to do something to overcome the toxin that was now in your system.
Right. You know, like, whether or not the snake knew what it was doing when it bit me, like, I have to survive some poison now. So how do I do that? And I think that has been the more interesting, unexpected part of this journey is, like, what led me to make certain decisions as an expression of who I am and what agency I have in light of the limitations and opportunities that this experience has provided me.
You're listening to Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM, KVSHLP, Vashon Island, Washington. Jeff and Cindy Hoyt here. We're hanging out with Amanda Knox and Christopher Robinson, talking about the new book, Free, My Search for Meaning, that dropped this week. But also, concurrently, over in Budapest, There's a Hulu TV series that is depicting your story. It's in production, and 8 episodes are expected to drop late summer, early fall.
Yeah, later this year, yeah.
It was just a few weeks ago that they asked you to fly to Budapest where they were filming the police station scenes and the infamous 53-hour interrogation over, what, 5 days?
Yeah, so the final interrogation of
that
part.
The police knew that your mom was coming and they needed to get a confession out of you. And so they kept you up all night on that final night. And they asked you to come over and make sure they got it right.
Mm-hmm.
So you watched Grace Van Patten, who plays you in the series, and all the police characters interrogate you.
I feel like one of the big things about everything that I do, including, you know, the way that I portray people in my book and understand people, is like understanding that no one thinks of themselves as the villain of their own story, but also no one is a villain unless they're like truly a psychopath. And that everyone in the room had their own preconceptions and had their own goals and everyone else, you know, they were all exhausted because they had all been working endlessly for hours. And so like really giving clues to the actors, like what are their motivations and what is each person bringing to the table and how are they each confronting Amanda and trying to get what they want and they believe from her. And then of course, how Amanda over the course of this interrogation is psychologically manipulated and comes to doubt herself and then to doubt her own memories and then to believe what they're telling her and then to try to imagine what they're telling her. Like there's this really like intricate psychological progression that is happening and we're having to condense that into a scene in a TV show. And I think like the biggest takeaway that I can say about working on this show has been that I've been so impressed and honored and touched by how much care is being put into this show by everyone involved. I have been extremely moved by how much everyone cares to get it right, which is astonishing given like my past experience of like no one really gives a shit. So
sign this check, please.
Exactly. So like, I'm so excited for when this comes out because it really is a collective effort of like trying to tell this story in a truthful way, in a meaningful way, in a way that sheds light in new ways for new people on this past event. And, you know, it's a very different thing than, you know, Free, My Search for Meaning, which is written by Amanda Knox. You know, like these are my words. This is like my perspective. And while the show is very much from my perspective, it is a work of many loving hands. And I've just been very touched by how loving those hands have been.
Well, we can't wait to see that. And I'd like for you to turn to page 218 in that book, because I was quite moved by a little passage in there. I bracketed it for you.
Okay.
That is about what you wish for Eureka. Your daughter,
yes.
Who's 3 years old. I think she was just a few months old when we first met.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Talk to us a little bit about that.
Absolutely.
And read that passage.
As I continued trading letters with Giuliano, I wondered how Eureka would learn about my past. I worried that, despite my best efforts, she would end up living in the shadow of my wrongful conviction, and that the media content mill that objectified me would objectify her. I wanted her to feel free in spite of my deep fear for her, fear shaped by my own trauma. I knew pain would manifest in her life. It does for all of us. But I hoped that when it did, she would not have to fight for her freedom. That freedom would be as natural as air. And as my own mother hoped for me, I wanted her to be kind to herself and others, especially when life is unfair. I wanted her to grow up to be the sort of woman who would extend a hand to those who'd harmed her. And then, of course, you know, now Eureka knows the story of my life way earlier than I thought she would. But yeah, you know, being pregnant really put into perspective this sense of urgency I had to sort of get my arms around this grief and around this trauma in such a way that I wasn't going to inadvertently spill it onto her, and also to protect her from how this like ongoing trauma was manifesting in my life. Like people showing up outside of our wedding and writing mean little headlines about it, or, you know, like it seemed like every little milestone in my life was a constant reminder of like how I had things that Meredith didn't have. And I didn't want that to be how Eureka was treated in the broader media and public. Like, oh, she gets to exist, but Meredith's children don't get to exist. Like, what a horrible thing to put on an innocent child. Mm-hmm. Or like the death threats that we got where people were saying, I hope Eureka gets murdered so that you understand what Meredith's mom had to go through. It's just like stuff like that. And it's like, I do not need people to be death threatening my child. I had this paranoia of like, oh my God, like, how do I protect my daughter and how do I teach my daughter and what is she going to know about me and when is she going to know it and how is she going to know it? And so it really put into me a sense of urgency of wrapping my mind and my heart around how to grapple with this ongoing trauma. And it was a big push for why I ended up reaching out to Mignini.
At the end of the book is this wonderful chapter called A Benediction. That contains your fondest wishes for the reader. How about your fondest wish for the writer?
I feel like love is like that, where we wish onto others what we need for ourself. So in a way, like what I say in the benediction, which I can, you know, pull up, is also a wish for me. I want to be free. I want to be safe. You know, these are reminders for me of what's important to me. You know, may you never confuse kindness with weakness. You know, people think I'm crazy for being nice to somebody who hurt me, but it's not crazy. It's an affirmation of what I believe to be true, which is that kindness is a strength. May you accept the apology you will never get. I'm never going to get the apology that I deserve, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like all of these things that I wish upon the other person, I mean, it's in the language of a metta meditation, metta being, you know, a loving kindness meditation. And in loving kindness meditation, you start by wishing to the world some good thoughts, like may you be at peace, may you not experience suffering. And then you learn to turn that onto yourself. Because it's so hard to like wish well upon yourself, you feel self-conscious and weird about it. So you turn that attention towards somebody you love, like your child. It's really easy to want loving things for your child, for them not to suffer, for them to be free, for them to have strength in the face of suffering, like all of that. And then you take that loving kindness attention and you turn it towards the world or the people that you're upset with or yourself. And so I think the benediction is as much a prayer for other people and the readers as it is for me.
The book is called Free, My Search for Meaning by Amanda Knox. And it's a wonderful book.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Thanks.
It's just great. And I wish you all the best and all the best in the world for getting this out to people. And it's got a lot of meat in it.
Yeah, there's it's got a lot of gut. There's a lot of viscera.
There's a lot of message, and but also great storytelling. And
it's funny.
Yeah.
It is.
You wouldn't understand that from this interview.
No. I need to pepper in some jokes there.
Well, I think people can tell you're funny. And
yeah.
Yeah.
You can make trauma funny, turns out.
Yeah. And in fact, that's one of the best ways to respond to it is by finding the humor in it. So,
Amanda and Chris, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us.
And for being role models of this attitude toward the next generation, because that's how it proliferates in the world.
Yeah, I'm just doing the best I can with what I got and hoping for the best. So,
how about where to find you? I know we've got your podcast. We're playing on Voice of Ashon now, Labyrinths. We just played your 5-part false confession series.
Yeah, I'm hoping people are really enjoying that.
They are, from all the feedback I'm getting.
Okay, great.
We're going to put up some more episodes, some of your favorite kind of best of episodes in the weeks to come.
Awesome.
But if people want to reach out, how do they find you?
So the best way to reach out is through amandaknox.com. That we have a contact form. So if you send us an email through that contact form, I will receive it. Otherwise, we're on socials on Blue Sky at amandaknox.com, on Instagram at amamanox, Although don't message me there because I don't look at messages. Chris does. Go to AmandaKnox.com if you really want to reach out and connect. Yeah. That would be the best way.
And Chris?
Yep. I'm on Blue Sky at wisecracker.bsky.social, at mccarbon on Instagram. I'll also receive messages through AmandaKnox.com. And you'll get updates there about readings Amanda's doing, book events.
Sign up for the newsletter because then we'll give you little reminders of what's going on.
She will definitely be doing something at Elliott Bay and hopefully hear something on Vashon.
Well, we'll look forward to all the details on that. But in the meantime, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Great to have you.
Since we recorded this interview, a reading event has been set here on Vashon. It'll happen on Saturday, April 19th at 5 o'clock at the Puget Sound Zen Center. That's along Vashon Highway. I'll be on stage asking Amanda questions. She'll also be taking questions from you in the audience and signing copies of her new book, Free, My Search for Meaning.